would be a little different if it was hot. Where number one, I might be a little bit slower and a little bit more lively on the subject, because I have recent notes, and if that's not being referred to my notes a couple of years before I lost them, then it would probably come out better. And in this talk, I'm assuming that people are already students of those Christian philosophies, so I'm not going to go into a long explanation of everything about the topic. This is a very difficult topic we need to talk about. And the reason for that is that one can only speak effectively about something spiritual to the degree that one can live it, or to the degree that one can endeavor or try to live it. And in recent years, my performance has not been very good. It has not been very successful in this exercise. Hopefully what will happen is the machine by all of this and to strive to work harder at it. In the early years of my aspiring to a higher life following the philosophy of the Christian fellowship, this exercise was the most instrumental in helping me to change my character and my moral life. Then as we grow, trials come. And it's been my experience in observing people who are spiritual aspirants, especially in the institution philosophy, that the trials that come with success are much more difficult. They're much more devastating if you don't do them than the trials that come from unsuccess. If a person is unsuccessful, one is protected and humbled. And when that happens, a person is open and eager for anything that helps. And they want to do anything to get out of their situation. What happens with success is that we can't take credit for the success. And when that happens, egoism becomes stronger in our life. And it's a very insidious kind of egoism that smugly thinks to itself, I have accomplished. And the accomplishment is usually, in reality, much less than we think it is. Now, in myself, egoism usually becomes manifest as laziness. And I have been lazy about the performance of this exercise, or this kind of exercise, for the last few years now. You know, we all go through cycles. And there are trials in each part of the cycle. And in the down part of the cycle, we really are earnest in our prayers. We really are humble. And in the high part of the cycle, everything's going our way. And we're happy. And we think we deserve it. And in a way, we do deserve it, but that's not the way we think we deserve it. It's in a much different way. So I'm striving to become like St. Paul, who said, I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. So whether things are happy or whether things are sad, one is uniform or even in one's spiritual aspiration. So, in embarrassing myself by giving this talk, maybe we'll burn off some of those scales of egoism. The topic of this talk is retrospection. According to Max Heindel, who is the founder of the Rosicrucian Fellowship, it is the most potent tool available to anyone seeking soul growth. No matter what their religion, no matter what their age, no matter what their state, is the most potent tool that we can have if we want to work on self-improvement or on building inner faculties. It is an exercise that you will see that is very firmly based in cosmological principles. It is an exercise that the founders of the Rosicrucian Order, the Inner World Organization, spent centuries on in studying how to do something like this, how to produce this kind of exercise and experiment. They're very careful about things like this because spiritual exercises, if not performed right, or if they are not really good spiritual exercises, can outright devastate a person's life. It can drive a person insane if you're not doing the right thing. Now, Max Heindel said that even if you took the most incorrigible criminal in the world and you could get them to sincerely perform this exercise every day for a half a year, your life would be perpetually, or would be permanently changed for the better. That's quite something when you think of the kind of monsters that are in our prisons. But that somebody would be permanently reformed is what the statement is. There are some key words in that statement. And one of those key words is sincerely. It's an exercise that has to be done with earnestness, with sincerity, with really caring about what one is doing. And that's pretty hard to do every day. It is one of those things. It is an exercise that has to be done every day. Since we are all spiritual aspirants, what I want to focus on in this talk is not all the benefits and all of the descriptions of the exercise, because that would be too much. It should actually be about three or four talks in order to cover things right. What I want to talk about are some of the problems that we have with it in our working with it. And there seem to be questions about that. And one of those questions is, if this is such a simple exercise, why is it so difficult to perform? Why is it so difficult to do that regularly? And so we're going to go into those things. Now, retrospection is something that is described in many different ways, or many different aspects of retrospection are brought out in the writings of Max Heindel. We can't look at all of them. We will review some of them and we'll try to answer these simple questions. Why, if this is such a simple exercise, why is it so hard to perform? Let's begin by reading the most simple and the most basic description of retrospection. It's from the Cosmic Conception, and it's called in there the evening exercise. The evening exercise. The evening exercise retrospection is of greater value than any other method in advancing the aspirant upon the path of attainment. It has such a far-reaching effect that it enables one to learn now not only the lessons of this life, but lessons ordinarily reserved for future lives. After going to bed at night, the body should be relaxed. Then the aspirant begins to review the scenes of the day in reverse order, starting with the events of the evening, then the occurrences of the afternoon, of the forenoon, and the morning. He endeavors to picture to himself each scene as faithfully as possible, seeks to reproduce before his mind's eye all that took place in each picture scene, with the object of judging his actions, of ascertaining if his words conveyed the meaning he intended or gave a false impression, or if he overstated, if he understated in relating experiences to others. He reviews his moral attitude in relation to each scene. At meals, did he eat to live, or did he live to eat, to please the palate? Let him judge himself, and blame where blame is due, praise where praise is merited. People sometimes find it difficult to remain awake till the exercise has been performed. In such cases, it is permissible to sit in bed till it is possible to follow the ordinary method. The value of retrospection is enormous, far-reaching beyond imagination. In the first place, we perform the work of restoration of harmony consciously, and in a shorter time than the desired body can do during sleep, leaving a larger portion of the night available for outside work than otherwise possible. In the second place, we live our purgatory and first heaven each night, and build into the spirit as right feeling the essence of the day's experience. Thus we escape purgatory after death, and also save time spent in first heaven. And last but not least, having extracted day by day the essence of experiences which make for soul growth, and having built them into the spirit, we are actually living in an attitude of mind and developing along lines that would ordinarily have been reserved for future lives. By the faithful performance of this exercise, we expunge day by day undesirable occurrences from our subconscious memory, so that our sins are blotted out, our auras commence to shine with spiritual gold extracted by retrospection from the experiences of the day, and thus we attract the attention of the future. The pure shall see God, said Christ, and the teacher will quickly open our eyes when we are fit to enter into the hall of learning, the desire world, where we obtain our first experiences of conscious life without the dense body. Pretty good writer. This is a statement that's worth reading and rereading on a regular basis to refresh in our minds what we are trying to do and how to do it. Now, as you recall, the words that I accentuated were words that were in italics. And in there, one of those italics says we are instructed to review the scenes of the day in reverse order and to picture each scene as faithfully as possible. Now, there seem to be two ways that this can be done. And you'll see that one of these two ways is clearly what is intended, even though the other way will work until then. When we first begin with this work, both ways are intertwined. Now, the first way to proceed is using the ordinary brain memory that comes through sensory experience. The second way is to use the breath record that is impressed on the negative ether of our vital bodies, wherein we have a perfect picture of everything that we have done in life. The first means to reconstruct images from memories, and those memories are associated with traces in the brain, both physical and etheric. And this is a pretty laborious task. It's hard to do. The But if we have no other way of doing it, it's worth the effort to reconstruct those images. When I first began following the Rosicrucian path, which was about 43 years ago, actually 45 years ago, what happened was I would go to bed 3 or 4 hours earlier than I intended to go to sleep. And those 3 or 4 hours would be spent on retrospection. And I made amazing advances because I had a pretty polluted kind of consciousness. I was an atheist and I did drugs and, you know, everything you can think of that was wrong, I did. And so I needed cleaning up very badly, and it did a great job of that. And of course, when you're young and in your 20s, you don't have the responsibilities that you have as life goes on. I lived for the other world more than I lived for this world, and so it was no bother to me to put all of the energy into that kind of activity. Now what happens when we summon up pictures rather than reconstruct them is something different. In our language, when we're reconstructing images, we are remembering. That is, to put the members of something back together. And that's not a whole process. Now, in this, Max Heindel tells us that when we are earnest and become proficient, he says this exercise can be done in as little as 15 minutes, which is something that I find totally fantastic. You couldn't do that if you were reconstructing the images. With the breath record, all you have to do is call up one image after another and put your consciousness into it, and then in the next one, and the next one, and it is conceivable to me that it could be done in that short of a period of time. In fact, I think it could be done faster than that, but I doubt that it would be very efficient. All right? Now, another one of the italicized words in there was reverse order. The instructions tell us to review the events of the day in reverse order. And this opens up many things about the nature of this exercise. All forward-looking things in our life work through and with the archetype of our life, with that spinning thought form which constructs our bodies and our lives and everything in it. As an act of will, before we come to birth, the spirit, with all of the will to live that it has, to come back and do something, activates that archetype and sets it spinning. Now, with things that spin, the direction of the spin is very important. When the direction of spin is forward, it tends to engage the spirit more and more deeply into matter. As long as the spin continues, the concrete forms are sustained, and life in the concrete realms progresses forward. So forward-looking is incarnate. Obviously, children who are looking forward to going to school or getting a driver's license or whatever are incarnating themselves more and more deeply into matter. At death, when the will to live that set the archetype spinning, when that impulse has tired itself out, or if it gets interrupted, everything unravels. And the spin is in the reverse direction. And we return inward and upward toward the spiritual realms when this happens. and the physical bodies, as a consequence, dissolve, because there's nothing holding them together. There's nothing moving things forward. So backward spinning, or even backward looking, is excarnating. It takes us out of the flesh. Now, from the cosmology section, part two of the Rosicrucian cosmo conception, we recognize that these principles are active on a very grand scale in the cosmos. During the first half of the evolutionary creation, it is called involution. Everything is going deeper and deeper into matter. Even the states of matter become more and more deep. In the second half, the evolutionary half of the evolutionary creation, the creative work still proceeds forward, but the divine beings participating begin looking backward. And what this does is it has the effect of dissolving one world after another from the most dense to the most rare and returning back to the spirit. It also has the effect of taking all of the experience that has been obtained in these worlds and in these bodies and building them as soul material into the body, into the spirit. And so what we're looking at is an exercise that is based on the very activities of the evolutionary creation. And the word that is used for saying that is that these exercises are cosmologically based. They're based on what we're going to be doing anyway. And we're not doing something foreign from the activity we're participating in. It's when we do foreign things that we get into trouble. Like right now in our agriculture, we bring in all kinds of chlorine poisons or halogen poisons in order to kill insects or certain types of plants or things like that. And when we bring that foreign substance, which is completely foreign to our evolution, we produce a poison that kills everything in the evolution, or it gives us cancers or whatever kind of thing it may be. So when we... this happens to us automatically. When we die, we see our lives backwards. Sometimes even when we have a near-death experience, such as if a person falls, or if a person almost drowns, or if a person takes psychedelic drugs and has that kind of out-of-the-body experience, they see their whole life backwards. And they are doing an involuntary retrospection, a mandatory one, so that nothing is lost of the experience from the life that they have just lived. So when we do this, we are consciously, we are doing something that is going against the wishes of the archetype. The archetype wants us to keep going forward, but if we try to glean the experience during the ongoing stages of life, we are volitionally going against that, and that's a very hard thing to do. It takes a lot of will, and it takes a lot of love to put our consciousness in such a way that we can harvest that kind of information. Since this is an activity, this is that is like the evolutionary half of the creation, it is excarnating. So when we lay in our beds and we look at the events of our day, and in the one before that, in the one before that, it has us looking backward, and it takes us right out of our body. And since our vital bodies are not yet really rich, and since we haven't learned how to transfer our consciousness into the inner bodies, what happens? Fall asleep. And this is one of the big problems that students of the Rosicrucian Fellowship have. We try to do this, and we find ourselves going to sleep. So that is one of the reasons why this is such a difficult exercise to do. It takes great love, and it takes great care to work backwards without falling to sleep. I have known a person, I mentioned this in a conversation the other day, I've known a person who did not want to fall asleep, so this person stood up in the shower, with the shower on, trying to retrospect, and it still fell asleep. Now that's really something. Now, at this point we have to stop the flow of this talk, because we're discussing some of the difficulties of the exercise that we have all gone through, at least anybody that I've ever known that has tried to persist in this exercise. Now we have people here that have never done this exercise and have never tried before. We don't want to give a defeatist attitude. We don't want to intimidate people from even trying to do things, because some people do have a lot of self-doubt. If one has the love and really wants to help the world, this is still a very simple exercise. We're not trying to place negative suggestions. We're not trying to suggest to people, hey, you're going to fall asleep. So we don't want to make it hard for anyone. Recently, I worked together with the Detroit group, and we did a summer school like this in Detroit. And there was someone in the group that had never been there before and came to this summer school. And she said, I'm going to try that. And the next day she comes back and she says, wow, it was like watching a video. And I saw my whole day, and here we are, all people that are struggling, went through the retrospection, and she did the whole thing. And she came back the next day and said the same thing. I almost wanted to get on my knees and worship her. Because she was pretty.
That's why.
No. So let's not be too negative about it. Now, the viewing of things in reverse order has effects in the other worlds, in the other realms that are different levels of existence. For example, looking backwards from consequence to cause, it leaves us no doubt but that there is a connection between the consequences in our life and the causes. But looking at the connections between consequence and cause by going backwards is primarily an intellectual exercise. And it's a nice thing to do, but we're trying to do something like that. But that's something that you can do, and it's still helpful, even though it isn't exactly what we want to do. It's always important to look back. Now, if some of you have taken a walk over here, you see a part of the lake very calm, and it's called Monona Bay. On the far side of Monona Bay, you can see tall buildings from the university, and that's where I used to work when I had my career. And when it got to be winter time, I didn't always want to take my bicycle to work when there was snow. And when it got to be winter time and the ice got to be about that thick, I would walk across Monona Bay because it was a shortcut. And after a fresh snow, I would try an experiment. I would try to walk straight across Monona Bay. And every 50 or 60 yards, I would look back. And the way you look back is you lay your head on the snow, and you probably look at the tracks, and you can see what your course has been. And I was astounded, even though I thought I was walking straight, at how serpentine and irregular my course was. And this is an intellectual example of what it is like to look back and see, did I really say that, or did I really do that? Because what we're looking at is fact. We're trying to look at the reality that we created. I did find a way that you could imagine. See, I have one leg shorter than the other. When I was a young man, I was stupid, and I played football. And I had a privilege to get locked into the joint, and then I had an operation on it, and I was still growing at that age. So that my left leg is about 3/4 of an inch shorter than my right leg. It's just difficult for me to walk a straight line. But what I found is also another spiritual principle. If I took one object, like a lamppost or the door of a house, and I never took my eyes off of that object, I can make a pretty straight line. And that's also what the spiritual life is like. If you have that in mind and nothing else, you're going to lead a pretty straight life, and your life is not going to be so certain. All right. Now there is one effect of this exercise which is active in all the worlds and all the bodies. It is implicit in what we said a few minutes ago, or when we read the description that we read. The effect of looking backwards is to neutralize or discharge material from experiences and to take them into the spirit as soul material. We want to neutralize the charge from the experiences that we carry around and extract the essence of the experience and bring it into our spirit to enhance our consciousness or to feed the spirit, so to speak. This effect is most important in the desire world and in the desire body, because this is an exercise for moral improvement. It's an exercise for character building, and that's the greatest need for spiritual advancement. One of the chief reasons that we don't have powers or that we don't have spiritual faculties is because we can't be trusted with them. We can't be trusted with those things. If you don't believe that, if you retrospect very carefully, you'll find all kinds of subtle mismotivations. The elder brothers and the divine beings would love to give us powers. They would love to help us unfold clairvoyance of any kind. But they can't do it because we're not worthy of it, and we would probably abuse it. Now, this doesn't mean that we're evil people. Probably everybody in this room is a very good person. Probably not good enough. Probably all of us have a good deal of the taint of selfishness, at least enough so that we can't be trusted. And probably all of us have a touch of anger in us. Now just think, if we had unfolded the power of healing, that power of healing could kill. If we got angry with someone and we had that kind of power, we could just wipe them out. So this is the very fact that we have not, I can't judge you because I'm not clairvoyant that I can see everything in your lives, but I'm guessing from interactions from you that I don't think that most of you are outright healers, that you have great spiritual powers. It's very easy, even for good people, to be led astray. We can be tempted and we can think we're doing such good things and suddenly find ourselves down the garden path going the wrong way. If we think about the Lemurian epoch, right after the fall, we were very pure. We were innocent. We were innocent like animals are innocent. We didn't have all the guile and all the egoism that we have now. But we still, even in that state of purity, got misguided, so that we have come down into the world in the way that we are now. In the desire world, the change of view is much more than temporal. The reverse is more than a reverse in time. It is a reversal of viewpoint. And it is a change of spiritual reference with regard to the facts or to the reality of our life. In the desire world, it is a world of qualities. Color is a quality. It's not a sequence in time. And the color of our emotions is more important than the sequence that it comes in. Emotions have many, many tones to them. And if you find a person who is very developed in their desire body, they have extremely elaborate tones of feeling, such that most people can't even discern all of them. In the desire world, things like whether one is giving and receiving things that are attracted as a result of that giving, or whether one is taking and repulsing because of the energy that is set up in the desire world when we take something to ourselves, that's something that's more important than whether something came before or after. This is why a great emphasis is placed on feeling in this exercise. And this is so important that we're going to take a little time and go into it. In this exercise, for want of a better word, we re-feel. And re-feel means something very specific. We will not discharge the desire forms that we carry in our subconscious if we do not re-feel them. They will continue to be there, and they will continue to bother us. And the refeeling, when we do the refeeling, has to be equal in intensity and in quality. That is, if it isn't equal in intensity or in quality, there will be no neutralization. And without neutralization, we can't extract the essence, the seed of what we have put into the emotional experience. If we put more feeling into it, or less feeling, it isn't a neutralization. What we want is the exact reality of what our desires, of what our feelings, what our emotions, or what our passions were. We want the exact. We want reality. And there is, you know, if you write, you're trying to connote a certain feeling, you want precision. Just a certain word or a certain set of words will set up that kind of feeling. All right, now we're going to talk about subject, and because in John's talk I have to tell you that I'm going to talk about something in a different way than they're normally used. We're going to talk about time and space. But when we talk about time and space, we're going to talk about them a little bit different than the way physics looks at them. And we're going to look at them a little bit different than the Gnostics looked at them. There is being, and there is non-being. They are both states within the absolute. There is the manifest, and there is the unmanifest. Between non-being and being, is a state that is potential. It is something that is potentially or latently in the absolute, but it has not become manifest. It has not become being. It has not been actualized. And that potential is polarized just like manifest being is polarized. And it is polarized into the potentials of time and space. And in the continuum, the pole that is a continuum that is called the spirit matter pole, that is within a continuum of potential that is time and space. Speaking very, very broadly, spirit, if you go in the direction of spirit along that continuum, that becomes more manifest in the character of time. Remember, we're talking about time differently than we are when we're talking about the clock. And matter, when you go in that direction on the continuum of the spiritual matter pole, that is much more in space. That's a little bit more obvious and a little bit more easy to think of. Because when we think of space, we think of extensive relationship. We take this room and we say that this room occupies space. And then we extend it and say we take the room and move it, and then we say that we have a space that is two rooms long. And we carry it on as far as we want to carry it, and we can carry it into different kinds of space that we can think of, and that is a spatial relationship. It's an extension. How long is it? How far does this go? Now, this world, as we perceive this world, is completely outer. There is no within to this world. If we take something, I took my hand and cut it open and spread the cut open, I would not see the within. What I would see would be a new without. We always only see the without. The spiritual worlds are not like that. With the spiritual worlds, you see things within. You see the inside of them as from the inside of them. And so they have a different, like you know the inwardness of something within your own self, which is why they are called inner. They are inner to you, and the inner of anything is within your own inwardness. Now, in the etheric subdivision of the physical world, the connection between the inner and the outer is a little bit more loose. And everything in the etheric subdivision is polarized, very much polarized, because the positive poles relate to those higher inner worlds, and the negative poles relate to the outer worlds. But when we get to the desire world, the space has a much different meaning. There's something analogous, but it's different. Suppose a desire clairvoyant sees a person, like John is right in front of me, and sees the person simultaneously with the sense organs of the dense physical body and through the vortex of the desire body with desire vision, you're seeing both simultaneously, and that's quite an achievement. At first, when you're clairvoyant, you have one or the other, and it takes really quite something to see both simultaneously. But what happens is, you see occupying space, you see John Stent's physical, but in that same space, there is the desire aura. But it's not made of the same stuff, and it's almost as if there's another space in the same locale. I don't even know how to put it into words. It's a very different kind of thing, and it's a very disorienting thing for people who have all of their consciousness in the dense physical. it's almost like going crazy to unfold clairvoyance at first, because you're seeing things suspended, and you know, you say, is that this world, or is that, or is it that world? And it takes something, it takes an inward consciousness in yourself to be able to rectify the relationship between the desire body and the physical body that you are seeing in two worlds in the same space. Now, I'm going to get a little far from my notes there. If one perceives solely in the desire world, it's much easier, because there you're looking at things relative to the laws of feeling and emotion and desire, and you're not looking at the laws and principles of two worlds at the same time. And that's a very difficult thing. There are things that are very maddening. I'll tell you a story. I have a friend, and this friend at one time had a complete waking experience in the desire world, in the inner worlds. And when this friend came back from that state of consciousness, two thoughts came to my mind. The first thought was, this isn't anything like Max and Rudy said it would be like. This person also studied St. Steiner, so the Rudy was Steiner. And he says, this isn't anything like Max and Rudy said it would be like, because I guess it was all chaos to him. And he said, after a few seconds, his thought was, oh my God, how could they be so objective about something which is so complex and so hard to understand? Because then he realized that there was all that objectivity that came through so clearly in those writings. And the Rosicrucian Cosmic Deception is a very clear book. And to be able to speak that clearly and objectively about something that is that difficult is quite an achievement. But there are analogies, as above, so below, what has gone before in heaven will follow after on earth. So there are analogies between all of the different worlds. So now we can get back on topic. We are getting back to the topic of speaking about retrospection and the desire world. And the Rosicrucian Cosmic Conception tells us something that is one of those chaotic things, but makes it seem very simple. When it's talking about postmortem experiences, and when the etheric panorama is over and the person has seen their life backwards for the first time with the neutrality of the images in the vital body, it enters the desire body. And when the being enters the desire world in the desire body, it is a very, very strange and disorienting kind of experience, because space is not so extensive in the desire world. Space is determined by the quality and the intensity of emotion and desire. Therefore, since we have desires and emotions in all the different realms of the desire body, in all the different subdivisions, and since we emotionally interacted with all sorts of people in all kinds of directions, it feels like your consciousness is expanded all over, like you have a universal consciousness, even though it's still your aura, and you can look back at your own desire aura. You feel like you're everywhere in the desire world at the same time. And it's especially disorienting when we have had a lot of very intense emotional interactions with people, and we've had them in all kinds of different places, and in all kinds of different conditions. But there's something about this reorientation that takes place when our consciousness gets spread out instead of looking at things from only our own personal point of view. There's something very important in this spatial reorientation. And that special thing that happens is objectivity. And this objectivity has a quality of irony about it. It is that when we are here in this almost exclusively outer world, we rarely get out of ourselves. We rarely become compassionate and see things the way other people see things. But when we're there, it's altogether different. And it produces a different kind of consciousness, a very objective kind of consciousness, to have that universal outlook as opposed only to the inward personal outlook. When we leave our body, it's more than just the physical activity of leaving our body. We are getting outside of ourselves, so to speak. We're getting outside of our personality so that we can look objectively at ourselves as other people look at us. And this is why, with respect to retrospection, Max Heindel often liked to quote Bobby Burns, where the Scots poet said, "Oh, would some God the gift he give us to see ourselves as others see us." And that's an important thing. In fact, it's so important that when I built the bathroom, I don't know how many of you noticed it. When you look at the mirror in the back in the bathroom here, that mirror has a name. It is the Max Heindel Bobby Burns Memorial Mirror. And because the two planes of the mirror come together like that, instead of seeing yourself reversed in mirror image, you in fact do see the image of your face as other people see it. Oh. Except if you look at only one panel and don't let the other panel in, then you get the normal vision. And it's a funny thing, if you look at that and you're looking and you're trying to get it right, and it's always as if that crack in the middle is doing something wrong. It's just that that's the intersection of the planes. Spatial reorientation is a psychological example. When we're personally in our bodies, we're very subjective. We're very egocentric. We're personally defensive. And so we're looking out for ourselves. But because ourselves are so small in this little personality of ourselves, we have a very small view of things. So we're very subjective, and we're hampered by that. We can never see the big picture. But when we're looking from the outside, we can see the big picture. For example, if we're watching people play cards, if we're watching them play chess, or if we're watching football on television, we're looking from the outside in. And we can say to the quarterback, "Hey, there's a guy open back there, throw to him." But because he's in the middle of it and he's very subjective, he may not be able to see it. This is the thing that marks a person with advanced objective consciousness, when they can be in their body and at the same time have the big picture. This is why I think Eddie Anderson has objective consciousness. When Eddie Anderson plays chess, he doesn't take it personally. And because he doesn't take it personally, he has this big objective view. He sees the game as the game. He doesn't see Eddie Anderson's struggle in the game. Well, he does sweat it out a little bit. I've seen that happen to him. But because he has the game in mind. And this is what happens when we are in the desire world. When we are in the desire world, we have a reverse of perspective. Now, this doesn't mean that every time we're doing retrospection that we have to try to get to the extents of the desire world, but it does mean that when we look at the images of our lives, we look at them from the viewpoint of the other person. This is why Orthodox Christians have been very successful with WWJD, if you know what that is. In Orthodox Christian terms, WWJD means, what would Jesus do? And they try to look at the situation not from their personal point of view, but from the viewpoint of Jesus. And that gives a kind of objectivity. And that's the kind of objectivity that we're trying to get when we do retrospection. Now, it happens naturally when you're in the desire of body and out of the body, but the images that are in the breath record, every time we take a breath, you carry in the ether that's in the atmosphere, and that gets carried to every negative pool of reflected ether in our body, and we have this panorama of everything. Now, mind you, this is a different kind of memory than the memory of the brain. The memory of the brain is associated with our senses. But the breath record doesn't have anything to do with the senses. It has to do with the whole reality. So it not only has all different points of view at the same time, it also has the emotions and the thoughts that are in the atmosphere. So this is quite a remarkable thing when we're dealing with the etheric memory. It can happen in retrospection that you can see someone that you were interacting with and you can feel that they were having a problem. And you can look at yourself and you can say, well, I was insensitive to that person's problem. That's not an unusual thing to have happen. It's something that takes us out of our petty view of life, our own personal little world, and takes us into the world of everyone else. The images that are in the etheric world are much more accurate than photos. It contained everything that was in the atmosphere. Now this brings us to a major point in talking about this exercise. When it says we are instructed to judge ourselves as accurately and fairly as possible. In other instructions, in other parts of the writing, we are instructed to feel the emotions and the desires as others felt them, as they came out of us. If we were angry and we were staring nails at someone, that is what comes out of us, and that is what we should feel. This is what that reversal produces. Now, each is a different kind of activity. Seeing it from within and seeing it from without. But the seeing it from without is very, very important because in the same way that we go from consequence back to cause and from cause to consequence, we have the whole picture. When we have the whole picture, we can relax because we know it. And when we have felt something as we put it out and when we refuel it, as it came out of us, that has the effect of neutralizing it. This is what is meant. Now I'm going to use a word, and I'm going to also use this word differently than the way John used it this afternoon. He used the word assessment for this. I used the word judgment. And by judgment, I don't mean condemnation, or I don't mean relegating someone to a fixed state of being because they have been judged to be this and they will be this forever. Judgment is a more lofty, it's an intellectual activity, and in judgment we comprehend the relative importance of things in the big picture. However, judgment is not artificial. It is not according to some moral code that the church says you should believe this way or my ethics course believes that you should behave this way. The facts of our emotions, feelings, and desires stand for themselves. That's what objectivity means. An object is what it is. And if that object happens to be a desire, like I sometimes have great trouble with lust. And that lust is what it is. I don't have to judge it. It is, just is what it is. Judgment is the comprehension of the meaning of facts. And that isn't necessary in the retrospection exercise. When you have experienced and re-experienced something, the essence of that experience, when it's taken into the spirit automatically judges it. It knows whether it's right or wrong. And there is a feeling of conscience, or there is a feeling, oh my God, I actually did that. You know, it happens automatically with the spirit. So with this kind of self-conscious spiritual comprehension, we can see the future, because we're in that more timeless state. Judgment guides and controls with intuitive accuracy. Refeeling is when we feel as exactly as possible each of our emotions and desires, and as they felt, as others felt them. It is more a matter of fact than it is a matter of assessment. If you just feel what you did and somebody else felt it, I had a thing, several years ago, I went to a class reunion. And in my class reunion, there was a woman that I hadn't seen since I left high school. And when she walked in, I used to do suggestive things to her. I used to bother her. She used to sit right in front of me in a class. And I would rub her butt with my knees. And I was, a horny, crazy kid. And when she walked in that room, I immediately felt it was just a natural thing. The intuition was there. And I immediately knew I had to apologize for her, because I knew that I had done wrong. I couldn't do it right then and meet all those people. But when I got home, I wrote her a letter. And she was utterly astounded. I said to her, I know it must have felt horrible, and please accept my apology for this. And that's an example of a feeling that neutralizes the feeling of the lust, the shame for what you have done wrong. When we do this with all of our emotions and feelings, the ones that are pleasant, the ones that are uplifting, and the ones that are unpleasant and dark. What happens often is people want to overdo it. And they focus especially and almost exclusively on the negative feelings. And the attitude is, well, I don't have to focus on the positive feelings. They're already in the bag. So it's necessary to go through them. But that leads to unbalanced development. Mm-hmm. And unbalanced development, we know what that is. That's psychological imbalance is another definition for not being all there, because we're looking at things either entirely too negatively, or we're looking at things entirely too positively. We want to be balanced people. We want to be the same as people we can be. And on top of that, we're not also advanced that we can forget about our good things that we've done. We all need encouragement once in a while. And we need to feel that joy of I've done something good or I've done something right. Now, just a very few minutes ago, we said that we should judge from reality and not according to some preconceived code. The same thing is true when we refeel. This is said because often spiritual students are very enthusiastic and they get zealous and they overdo And in such cases, there is a tendency to try to punish oneself for what are called bad desires or bad emotions. And punishment is reprehensible. Punishment is just starting a new bad desire train. The reality is enough in itself. You don't need to punish. If we try to punish ourselves, we do nothing but harm. We're not neutralizing anything, and we're adding more, and the ones that we're adding are very unnatural. Punishment is an unnatural activity. You don't find it anywhere in nature. Nature takes care of what it has to do, and then it's done. Doesn't try to punish. Punishment is an egoism thing. We have to teach this person a lesson, even if that person is ourselves. That's an unhealthy thing. If a person refuels from consequence back to cause, exactly what was put in the original cause, neutralization happens automatically. There isn't any special trick. All we have to do is see the reality. And when you see the reality, there's nothing more. This is it. The real is the real. We don't have to add anything to reality. In writing, if you put too many adjectives in there, if you try to make too strong of a case, you actually make a weaker case. And that's what happens. When one does this deliberately, and we're very keenly in our self-observation, the essence of experience is taken right in. We sort of, with our mind's eye or with the eye of ourself, we see it right into our being. We own it. We take responsibility for what we've done. We say, yes, I really did that. And when we see that, that seeing takes it into us, just like seeing with our eyes takes the light from the external world into us. Is it raining?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to have to... What? So at the same time, the form, the desire form that is created by an expression of desire, at the same time it dissolves, it gets recycled back into the desire world, and automatically the essence is taken back into the spirit. If we don't do that, we carry a lot of stuff around in us. And any psychiatrist can tell you, if he's a kind of psychiatrist that doesn't just give you drugs, but actually works with analysis, they can tell you you've got all kinds of things, all kinds of fears and hatreds and angers, and all kinds of delirious joys or things that we hang on to. And when we hang on to them, we're not clear. We don't have freedom of movement. I know there is a perfect physical example of this. I haven't seen her in a few years, but I've seen people similarly, and that is street people. There is an old woman that is a street person, and she has three suitcases full of all of her possessions, and she's had those three suitcases for years. She can't carry three suitcases. So she carries one or two of them ahead about 10 feet, and then she goes back and gets the next one, and she puts it on the street. And she does this for years. And she can't get anywhere. It takes her hours to go several blocks. I've looked at this, and I have been astounded at how she can hang on to that. And then you say to yourself, maybe in the desire world, we're doing the same thing. We're hanging on to all kinds of stuff. Some people are angry at people for a few words that were said a few years ago, and maybe the person even didn't think before they said them and didn't mean any malice, or maybe at least consciously didn't mean any malice. And we carry that around for a long time. And it's a weight. We're not free. We want to be able to breathe, so to speak, in our inner emotional nature. And so it's a very important thing, even if we don't retrospect every night, we can sit down once in a while, and if something comes to mind that has been bothering us, we can retrospect it right then, and we can clear ourselves from the past. People used to say that Sigmund Freud was a charlatan because he didn't tell any people what to do. He would just sit there, and the people would be laying on his couch, and they would say what happened and how they felt about it. And very often, they got better. And they got better because they had somebody there as somebody that they were retrospecting before. They were discharging those things. It clears things up. I'm going to have to get back to minutes again here. Yes. Let's talk about something that comes up. And it's come up for me a number of times. I've tried to help people, and I've tried to help them by suggesting retrospection. And very often this is what you hear, a sentence like this. I remember all those painful things, those bad things that happened before, and I don't get any relief from remembering them. If anything, it only makes matters worse. Now this is a keen observation. A person isn't lying. They're telling the truth. They're saying, well, I remember this bad thing that happened, and now I not only have the bad thing that happened to me, I have the memory of the bad thing that happened to me. That's not the kind of memory that we're trying to suggest here. There's a difference in remembering to forget and remembering to remember. When a person is doing that kind of thing, they are remembering to remember. And this is something that all of us have done. Suppose we've had an intense emotional experience. We've had a fight with someone. And we came out of it very bad. And we looked bad and we were humiliated and people put a guilt trip on us or all kinds of things like that. Our ego doesn't like being beat. Our ego is like John's being in the warfare business. It doesn't want to be defeated. And so it'll play it over and over again in memory. And each time we'll say, this is what I could have done. Or the next time this happens, this is what I'm going to do. That's not what retrospection is. That's the kind of memory that perpetuates it. And that makes it stronger. We're trying to remember to see what was exactly there and what we can get out of it. Because what we get out of it is spiritual gold. No matter how horrible the experiences we have, it becomes spiritual gold. Even if we murder someone, we draw the essence of that experience out, and we certainly do live a better life and understand what we want with someone else. So this is that argument that all I do is think about it more. That means you have to have a new technique. You have to have a technique not where you're trying to justify yourself, not why you're trying to prove yourself in a humiliating situation. You're trying to look at what you were doing. What the other person did is the other person's business. That is their destiny, and they're going to have to suffer it. You don't want to have them punish you by having you play this over again and again in that way that grinds it in. So you let go of what the other person did, and you understand what you did, and you draw the essence out of it, and it's done. There's a funny thing about history. Until the moment something happens, anything is possible. But once an event has happened, you can't go back. Time is irreversible, even though in some physics equations you can reverse it, but they're not talking about experience. Once you have experienced something, you can't go back and undo it and say that, you know, it didn't happen. But when you, so that's one part of it. No, I lost really part of my consciousness. This was an ad-lib part of the thought. The other part is that when you have experienced something and it's over, it's over. It doesn't have to be anymore. It's past, and it doesn't belong to you any more than it belongs to anyone else. That's another viewpoint of that objectivity. And you're looking at that universal objectivity the way you do as a grandstand quarterback. When you can look at yourself that way, you're free. It's a very freeing kind of experience. One last thing about this. We have something hanging. We never gave the second answer. We promised that we were going to give a second answer. Why is such a simple exercise so difficult? Why is such a simple exercise so difficult? The simple answer can be given in two words, but I'll probably take several hundred.
Let's hear the two words.
The simple two words are psychological resistance. We realize that we have in our unconscious part of our being this pseudo-self. It's not the real self, which is the divine part of us. The divine part of us can project an image of itself into the desire body, which is its reflective projection, and that image is what we call the lower nature, or the lower self, or that's the word we use, is the personal ego, or the pseudo-ego. It doesn't have much real reality. What it is a great big complex. At one time in our history, it protected us, because at the fall of humanity, the spiritual hierarchies could no longer lead us. Because when we fell, we said we are divine beings. We have the creative power and we're going to use it. And when we said that, we then became responsible for everything in our lives. Before, we were led through everything by guiding spirits. When we said that, we said we are gods. And the other divinities, the spiritual hierarchies, respected that in us. But we weren't strong enough to take care of ourselves without them leading us around. So they helped us. They didn't force us. They helped us build this pseudo-self in the desire body to take care of us. That was it. We needed that care. Well, over many millennia, that pseudo-self sort of built a fiefdom for itself. It built up its own little kingdom. And it realized that we in our consciousness, in our blinded state in the dense physical world, don't realize how cunning and that invisible pseudo-self is, and how it can get us to do the desires that it and the Lucifers wanted us to do. All of those things of sex and violence that permeate our culture. Sex being the sin of Adam, and violence being the sin of Cain. Those have been the primary sins. Whether it's the Defense Department, or whether people want to sit at home and watch a lot of videos or something like that. A lot of advancement in technical things. The Lucifers love technical advancement. They don't want holistic development. They don't want natural development. And so this pseudo-self has set up shop in our being. When we start to grow spiritually, we recognize that there is an inward struggle. In our spiritual waking consciousness, we know that this is the right thing to do, but somehow, working through the desire body, that lower self knows all of our weaknesses, and there we go. We did the very thing we didn't want to do in the first place. And it's almost as if we laugh at ourselves. Well, that second self, or that pseudo-self, when it comes to retrospection, it knows that if retrospection is successful, it's not going to be able to continue to lead us around willy-nilly the way it does now. So rather than having a few more hours or a few more minutes of desire, when we come to something where we have to face something that we did that was really bad, the lower nature is all too willing to help us go to sleep. And that's why it takes a lot of courage. We have to be able to stand up to that. Now, there's something that I have found that is very helpful with this. Because you watch yourself in everything you do. This is something we've been saying all week. Spiritual exercises are heuristic. They're self-educational. Now, some people, when they run into this psychological resistance, they choose to master and command themselves to stay awake and to go through all of the images and such like that. There's a lot to be said for that because it can be effective, and sometimes it's the very thing that is called for. That isn't agreeable always to me. I'm speaking personally now as Richard Kempster. We ask ourselves, is this the kind of person that I want to be? Do I want to be the kind of person that is demanding and commanding that everything that I do is a fiat? I say to myself, no, that's not what I want to be. Because we have to remember, what we do is what we become. And so, what I try to do now, when I run in these kinds of binds, when I know I've done especially bad things during the day, and most of them are against sins against myself more than against other people. I play God to myself and I play devil to myself. Another name for the retrospection exercise is the forgiveness of sins. Forgiveness of sins. Now, I have a peculiar view about this. I do not believe that humans can forgive. I believe that only Christ in the life spirit can forgive, because only Christ can bring that newness in that makes everything all new. Whereas the Bible says, behold, I make all things new. We can direct the love of Christ to forgive, but we ourselves can't forgive. That's just an ego trip to try to do that. And so, what I find helpful sometimes is to treat the retrospection exercise as confession. And this is somewhat redundant to what I said last night. If you picture yourself as being before Christ, or being before the center of being, you are automatically humble. And you say, yes, I did this for you, and it turned out to be good. Or you say, yes, I did this, I was thinking only of me, I was not thinking of you, or I was not thinking of anyone else. It's a good way to refill things in such a way, because you're standing before the being that said, I am the truth. And when you do that, you can't do anything but be exactly true to what happened. I think that's a helpful thing. I don't have much more to say than that. Obviously, there are a lot of different things that could be brought out about this, but I think enough is enough. Let's close with the Rosicrucian students' prayer. With God,
Are you taking any questions?
You said there's two different ways of going to the review, our brain way and a natural way.
Calling up the pictures.
Calling up the pictures. Is there a way of calling up the pictures?
It's a skill or a technique that you learn along the way. If you really want to be improving yourself, you say, well, it's again taking the line of confession, what did I do next that should be reviewed? And then it gets all up to you.
So you bequest it?
Yes. If you can't start the film going and see everything backwards as it unfolds that way, you can call up all of the ethers, the images that are perfect images. And they are remarkable. Now you do a lot of sewing. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if in your sewing you didn't call up a lot of those images. If you're sewing along and you're not completely occupied, your complete concentration is not focused on that, other things start coming up in your mind. And some of them are memory pictures from the past, and they're remarkably clear. And that's an example of what you're trying to do. That's why in the what we read, the description of the exercise says you relax. Because if you're not relaxed, you can't call up pictures that way. If you're washing dishes, it's happened to me a number of times, you're washing dishes. Whether you're washing dishes and your picture floored up inside and I'm just amazed at it. So I'm going way back to my childhood. Relax.
Well, Richard, what is the use of subjectivity if it seems like it doesn't have any good for us and all we have to do is be objective?
No, subjectivity is what we give God. What the personality gives to the spirit is a unique point of view. When I hear you laugh, especially when you laugh and it pierces me for my folly, that's something that is very unique, that I really enjoy. And that can only be because of your subjective experience.
Okay, so it's something we offer to God.
Yes. It is part of the law of service. And the law of service goes that because the universal spirit gave us this wonderful, wonderful schema that we're living in, when each of us unfolds our part of it and does something creative, each of us gives back to the universal spirit a new creation. And so for the one grand creation, the universal spirit gets a multitude of creations from every being that is going through the process. And each one is unique. And this is what's really nice when you look at horoscopes. You see, as we did today, we saw constructions, Saturn, Mars constructions, and each one did it in a different way. There's the same aspect, and sometimes the same aspect in the same signs, and it was unique. And so that subjective point of view is a very important thing. Because there are things that we can see from our subjective point of view that no one else can. Not even the Almighty. The only way the Almighty can see it is through us.